This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good afternoon, all. I'm Judd King. I'm pleased to welcome you to the first of this year's Clark Kerr Lectures. And I have the privilege and pleasure of saying a few words about Clark Kerr and the Clark Kerr Lectures. Clark was the first chancellor of the Berkeley campus. He was then president of the University of California during a decade that was both formulative for the university and turbulent. Clark was born in Pennsylvania in 1911. He was educated as an undergraduate at Swarthmore, for a master's degree at Stanford, and came to the University of California, where he obtained his PhD in economics in 1939. He is therefore a product of both the institutions that we have represented here today, Stanford and the University of California. In 1945, Clark returned as associate professor of industrial relations in the School of Business Administration, Berkeley, and as the founding director of the Institute for Industrial Relations. He achieved fame as a skilled negotiator between labor and management, dealing with such as Harry Bridges, for those of us who remember Harry. Building upon this background, he helped greatly in the negotiations and resolution of the California loyalty oath controversy. He also needed and used all those skills when he became the first of the campus chancellors in 1952. Fired with enthusiasm, a term which he later used in another way, he became president of the university in 1958. And during his time as president, he devised and oversaw the process by which many aspects of the administration of the university were devolved to the chancellors and to the campuses, leading to the strong University of California campuses and the system of governance that we today have. He created the essentials of that system of governance. He also oversaw the launching, development, and most important of all, the definition of three new campuses at Irvine, San Diego, and Santa Cruz. And those themselves have become major success stories over the last four decades. And not by his choosing, he became the first of many presidents of major universities to have to deal in a very public way with the great complexities and challenges brought to campuses in association with the social movements of the 1960s. His experiences as president are well and engagingly chronicled in his two-volume book series, The Gold and the Blue, published by the University of California Press. Upon leaving the presidency of the University of California, Clark became chair and director of the Carnegie Commission on the Future of Higher Education, and then the Carnegie Council on Policy Studies for the period 1967 to 1979, 12 years, during which he and his associates turned out a remarkable series of reports that have provided sound guidance to higher education ever since and have really never been duplicated in magnitude or scope. In 1963, Clark Kerr gave a series of lectures known as the Godkin Lectures at Harvard University. In those lectures, he presented concepts of research universities and coined a term, the multiversity, to describe the myriad interconnecting activities that exist synergistically within our leading universities. Those lectures live on in a book entitled The Uses of the University, which has reached its fifth edition now, and Clark added prefaces all along as those editions came out. The Clark Kerr Lectures are modeled after those Godkin Lectures. The subject is the role of higher education in society. The lectures are generously supported by a combination of the University of California and the Carnegie Corporation of New York. That combination, of course, reflects and symbolizes Clark's career and his vital contributions to the world of higher education. I'll now turn the podium over to Executive Vice Chancellor and Provost George Breslauer, who will introduce our lecturer.
Good afternoon. It takes a very special person to be worthy of giving a Clark Kerr lecture and Clark Kerr lecture series. And today, we continue in the tradition of attracting to this purpose very, very worthy people. Donald Kennedy has had an extraordinarily distinguished career in academia and elsewhere. He received his PhD from Harvard University and then joined the Stanford faculty in 1960, and he's on that faculty to the present. He was president of Stanford University from 1980 to 1992. He's also an eminent scientist. At Stanford, he was director of the program in human biology in the mid-70s and chair of the Department of Biology from 1964 to 1972. Either the jobs were easier then or, Dr. Kennedy, you have absolutely extraordinary resilience. He currently conducts research on environmental challenges such as major land use exchanges and changes, economically driven alterations in agricultural practice, global climate change, and the development of regulatory policies. For the quality of his contributions to science and to higher education, he's been elected to membership in the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. He served a stint in government. He was commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration in the Carter administration. He is currently director of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He co-chairs the National Academy's Project on Science, Technology, and Law. He is also editor-in-chief of the journal Science, which is one of perhaps the most distinguished scientific journals in the world. He, in short, has had a career that has equipped him well to reflect upon the role of higher education in American society and the ways in which it has evolved over the decades. He'll speak today in his first lecture on the topic Science and the University, An Evolutionary Tale, Part One, The Endless Frontier. I'm tempted to say, President Kennedy, I invite you to the podium.
George, thank you very much, and I've been really treated wonderfully here, and I'm deeply grateful for the invitation and the opportunity. I'm one of the world's luckiest of men. For 47 years, I've been able to be a member of a faculty at a very good university to the south of here, and been able to make frequent visits to friends and colleagues and to observe occasional disturbances at the greatest public university in the world. And it's a privilege to be here and to be represented as somebody who could do something worthy of the memory of Clark Kerr, an inspiration to all of us who are lucky enough to try to follow in his path. He was not only wise and scholarly and graceful and relentlessly funny, he was full of counsel and good cheer for those of us who thought we might be in the successor generation. As I was working my way along an academic career myself, I caught up to the Godkin lectures in 1963 and thought they were just extraordinary descriptions of what the university was really like and what it might become. The Godkin lectures, as originally given at Harvard, are a seamless and beautifully crafted account of the transforming events of the 50s and early 60s, right up to the free speech movement on Kerr's flagship campus here. And it's a wonderful thing to read again, but the copy that you buy today, which keeps the original title, also includes, as Judd mentioned, new chapters based on essays he wrote at approximately decadal intervals following the delivery of the original Godkin lectures. These constitute chapters 4 through 9, with the 9th being composed of a remarkably thoughtful scenario-building exercise in which he suggests what the city of intellect, a term he coined in the first Godkin lectures, might look like in the future. Well, that suggests a certain kind of launching pad for my own effort to honor him. So here's the game plan for these 3 lectures. If I can do a good enough selling job, you might even come to the second. That's my hope. First, the great event in the history of science in its relationship to the universities was plainly the events that followed World War II and injected the fusion of public funds into the enterprise. Other courses of action surely could have been taken by the United States government. It could have invented something like the Max Planck Institutes in Germany. It could have invented something like the CNRS institutions in France. It could have elevated and multiplied the national laboratory complex. But it did none of those things. It did a very much more sensible thing instead, at least in, I hope, in our judgment. Relied on a 1945 report from Vannevar Bush, the head of the wartime Office of Science and Office of Scientific Research and Development, who drew a clear line to define the role played by fundamental non-applied science as the driver of development and application. He called it Science, the Endless Frontier. That report moved the wartime military science machine into the universities, the very same places where the next generation of scientists were going to be trained. And that convergence was a key aspect of the Bush proposal. So it was a wonderful introduction of prosperity for university science, but the partnership between government and university science also was attached to some new challenges, even maybe some suspicions, possibly even occasional buyer's remorse on the part of the grateful recipients in academia. So that's the first, and you're going to hear the rest of it in a little while, if you'll be patient. The second lecture, I want to explore a successor revolution, one in which the ownership of intellectual property in science shifted in a really tectonic way. It gave rise to the development of a new set of commercial enterprises that existed kind of in the penumbra of the great research universities. The Bayh-Dole amendments of 1980 were responsible for what I want to argue was an enclosure of Bush's endless frontier. In fact, it's one with an interesting echo in that one can claim that it did to the intellectual property on the landscape of science's endless frontier just about what the Homestead Act had done to the real property in the 19th century roadless West. Whether the Bayh-Dole amendments were responsible for creating, as some would have it, a knowledge anti-commons through that enclosure, or whether they were a good thing, has been a candidate for continuing debate. But one thing is certain, and that is that science in the universities and science outside them took on a radically new relationship. In the third lecture, which will be delivered at Irvine, we'll look at the perennial struggle between the secrecy associated with national security needs and the openness traditionally associated with science, especially science in the universities. This is an old confrontation. It emerges and reemerges in ways that have changed the nature of the relationship between science and government. Part of the problem relates from the separate cultural histories of the groups of people that are engaged in performing each of those enterprises. Each has its own culture. Some speak of the scientists as nerds and the security people as spooks. The nerd spooks metaphor doesn't exactly get it, but it does point out that there are strong cultural differences between the two purposes. Complexity is added because it pits government agents often against scientists who have their own need for transparency. When secrecy is used to conceal scientific findings that might interfere with desired government actions, it becomes, as it has in recent years especially, a source of serious tension between members of the scientific community, their institutions, and their government. So that's the plan. And now I want to turn, of course, to the story of building science in American universities. But I want to point out that it did not begin full-blown from nothing at the end of World War II. The building in which I had pursued a doctorate in biology at Harvard in the early 50s is a fine structure with two rhinoceroses, or perhaps they're actually rhinoceri, at its entrance, which are a terrible temptation to undergraduate climbers. And it was built, the building, rhinoceroses and all, by the Rockefeller Foundation in the 1930s. Even earlier, Rockefeller had funded the Hopkins Marine Station at Stanford, and it had been generous to numerous other institutions that were trying to build especially institutional strengths in the biological sciences. Indeed, by 1953, Rockefeller had supported American biology to the tune of $30 million. That's in then-year dollars. But that was the end of that, and the Rockefeller Foundation turned to agriculture and began worrying instead about the Green Revolution. Interestingly, that was just about the time of the birth of the National Science Foundation and the beginning of the major uptick in funding of the National Institutes of Health. Okay, that is interesting, but it's not the right place to start. The right place for us to start is just at the end of World War II, where we can examine the events that began the explosion of science in American universities, taking the enterprise over from private philanthropy to build a whole set of new relationships that changed both higher education and government. So we begin in Washington, and in 1945, and Vannevar Bush, the director of OSRD, is at work in his study directing a response to a letter from President Roosevelt that Roosevelt had written a year earlier. In that letter, Roosevelt had asked four questions, which can be summarized briefly, and they're pretty good questions. How can we share the science we have done during the war effort with our citizens and a needy world without damaging security? A little bit of front loading there in that phrase. We'll get back to it. How can we turn our new knowledge in medicine in the war against disease? How can the government aid research in the public and private sectors? How can we develop scientific talent in our youth to assure the sustainability of what we have now? Well, Bush's response had to be directed to a different president because Roosevelt was gone and Harry Truman was the president. And Bush's response had a wonderful title. The document was headed Science, the Endless Frontier. I want to argue that the choice of that metaphor could scarcely have been more appropriate or, given what we have learned since, more fortuitous. The frontier, of course, brought back visions of an earlier American West, the West, indeed, of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. The metaphor thus connoted exploration, but of a very particular kind. Not a search for a specific goal, but rather a loosely guided expeditionary foray to find, describe, and ultimately understand what was new and therefore unknown. That's the Lewis Clark feel. It was endless because it was geographically unmarked, suggesting an exploration without a limiting boundary. Furthermore, it suggested not only unknown, but unowned space, a common pool resource inviting free intellectual access without the hindrance of proprietary interest. That was the power of the endless frontier. Bush's own language in the last paragraph of the letter he wrote, directed to President Truman 7 months later than Roosevelt's questions had arrived, suggests this vision. And in it he said, and I quote, "The pioneer spirit is still vigorous within the nation. Science offers a largely unexplored hinterland for the pioneer who has the tools for his task." Well, the construction of the response Bush attached to that letter is always interesting, and it is occasionally surprising. His initial summary lists a number of respects in which he views scientific progress as essential. What he put first, interestingly enough, was the war against disease. And as he constructs the case, he cites improvements in longevity, as well as the dramatic reduction in military death rates for Army personnel due to advances in battlefield medicine. But he directs attention to the rising cost of medical research and the diminishing scale of basic research support. So he calls for a major federal effort to support basic medical research in universities and medical schools. That's followed by a briefer account of our needs for improving science-based technologies for national defense, and Bush urges the nation to keep some civilian scientists who've made such advances during the war in the same line of work after the war. But the area in which Bush devotes most of his attention is the public welfare. And he begins with economic goals related to the public welfare. He talks about full employment and the need for what he calls new, vigorous enterprises. But then he adds that those enterprises are not born full grown, and that introduces a powerful case he makes for basic research as a kind of infrastructure for development and application. The central paragraph in his case concludes with these two sentences. "With some notable exceptions, most research in industry and government involves application of existing scientific knowledge to practical problems. It's only in the colleges, universities, and a few research institutes that devote most of their research efforts to expanding the frontiers of knowledge." Thence, Bush cut quickly to the chase, citing the limits of funding available for universities and research institutes. He says that, quote, "If they are to meet the rapidly increasing demands of industry and government for new scientific knowledge, their basic research should be strengthened by the use of public funds." Bush knew enough to attend carefully to the renewal of scientific talent. He calculated that the wartime deficit in baccalaureates in science, owing to the demands of military service, would be around 150,000. And he went from there to urge a combined program. First, new scholarships and fellowships would be directed to students showing a talent for science. A special effort would be made to identify soldiers in uniform who had, before or during the war, given evidence of talent for science. Taken with the recommendations for strong support of university science, this added up to a grand strategy. Put the most talented and promising young men and women in the universities and support university research so that the next generation can work with the last. The addition of the GI Bill, of course, rounded the program out. And the university I entered as a freshman in 1948 had already left behind a good deal of its pre-war past on account of those intentions and prospects. Well, there's an interesting contrast in the way some of these people expressed the needs. Bush was fairly closely associated with James Conant, the president of Harvard. In speaking of the needs for talent, Bush says, for example, the responsibility of the creation of new scientific knowledge rests on that small body of men and women who understand fundamental laws of nature and are skilled in the techniques of scientific research. He then quotes admiringly President Conant, who said that our rate of advance will depend, and here I quote Conant, on the number of really first-class men who are engaged in the work in question, close quote. One might, of course, speculate that Bush's experience with the military establishment had enlarged his view of gender roles, or perhaps that Conant still considered Harvard coeducational only in practice. The more interesting aspect of the Bush-Conant relationship, though, is the influence Conant had on the inclusion of science education among the objectives of his proposed National Research Foundation, the governance of which is Bush's next concern. So I'm going to turn to that in just a second. Having already made the case for the importance of basic science, Bush turns to the important matter of how you govern the new entity he has in mind, this new National Research Foundation. He makes brief reference to the importance of applied research in government, recommends a science advisory board to advise the government on the management and coordination of the various mission agencies already in government. It's no surprise to us, equipped as I suspect we all are with perfect hindsight, that that recommendation was dead on arrival, or at least it was not adopted, presumably because executive agencies and their legislative overseers and authorizers and appropriators are no more eager for that kind of oversight than they are now. A contemporary equivalent, of course, does exist now. It's the Office of Science and Technology Policy. But you would look for it in vain any time before 1976, when it was first given statutory life. Far from being an independent board of scientists that oversee what the science agencies in government do, it is plainly a part of the executive branch. Though I must say, recently demoted and rusticated by the current administration, it does not have offices in the old executive office building, is not really thought of as part of the White House, even though it really is. But as for Bush in 1945, the other Bush in 1945, he had far more important objectives involving the creation of the National Research Foundation. Here I want to talk about some of those objectives, but you will find in this account, unless I deliver it badly, that there is as much disappointment as there is enlightenment and pleasure as to the adoption of these devices. So I'm going to talk a little bit about governance and structure. And you know, if I were a PowerPoint person, which I am not, I would probably have an org chart up here to display what it was that Bush dreamed might be the governance of his new foundation. But here we go. The new entity was charged with all the purposes outlined in earlier sections of the report. The foundation should develop and promote national research policies for scientific research and education, support basic research in nonprofit organizations, develop scientific talent through scholarships and fellowships, and by contract support work on long-range military matters. The National Research Foundation was to have 9 members. All of them would be non-government employees, all of them selected by the president. They would serve 4-year terms and appoint a chief executive officer to be called the director. The director would be salaried handsomely, Bush proposed, but the members would be expected to serve pro bono. Below the members were five divisions, each with five of its own members selected by the foundation members. Now, aren't you sorry I don't have PowerPoint here? These could be paid, albeit modestly, and each division would have its own chairman selected by the foundation members. What surprises the contemporary viewer of this history is the list of the surviving divisions out of the five that Bush listed. Predictably, it has divisions responsible for the natural sciences and for scientific personnel and education. Those functions may be thought of as being wrapped up in the current mandate of NSF, the differently named but currently surviving version of the original Bush plan. But there are two prominent missing divisions. One is national defense, and the other is medical research. And we're entitled to ask, I think, what happened. The narrative of what happened describes, I think, one of the keystone events in the history of post-war science policy and science planning in the United States. Bush's rationale for including those two divisions in the National Research Foundation was his faith in the unity of the sciences. He said, "Science is a fundamentally unitary thing. The number of independent agencies should be kept to a minimum." And to this, he adds the following illustration. "Much medical progress, for example," he says, "will come from fundamental advances in chemistry. Separation of the sciences in tight compartments, as would occur if more than one agency were involved, would retard and not advance scientific knowledge as a whole." Well, what happened instead was that the national medical research enterprises supported by OSRD were handed over to the National Institutes of Health, while research in the interests of the nation's defense remained with other mission agencies like Defense and the Atomic Energy Commission, later Energy. So you can't read Bush's report and know what the outcome was without being curious about what kinds of politics intervened. In the case of medical research, the outcome had much to do with the traditional affection members of Congress had and still have for the health missions of the NIH. Congress had always maintained a special interest in supporting research on the diseases many of them feared they might experience themselves, and NIH managers became enmeshed in a tradition of cultivating good personal relationships with the Congress. Perhaps the most noted practitioner of that was Dr. James Shannon, who moved up from the National Heart Institute in 1955 to take the directorship of NIH. He was viewed as a past master at that kind of congressional relationship, although he had presumably begun to exercise it even as a division head before he had moved up in 1955. So medical research never wound up in the National Research Foundation or in its successor, the National Science Foundation. Of course, it can be argued that NIH has actually gone beyond medicine in its own research program. It does support the basic sciences, thus, in effect, responding to the spirit, if not the letter, of the Bush proposal. But in the view of many, the present situation is not conducive to a balanced portfolio of scientific investment. The current budget of the NIH is at $28.4 billion, vastly exceeding that of the present NSF at $5.5 billion. Nobody thinks that's a balanced portfolio, has a funny idea of balance. I might just mention in a digression that if one complains, as I have editorially in Science, about balanced portfolios and the need for them, noting, for example, that in the case of science is needed for examining new opportunities for biofuels, and so forth. The total federal budget for plant physiology and biochemistry amounts to less than 1% of the total NIH budget. That would include NSF, which has a number of programs, and the Department of Agriculture, which has a formula-funded program that doesn't include much independent investigator ROI kinds of projects, although a proposal for a competitive grants program in the Department of Agriculture was first approved in the last Ford science budget, but has built very slowly ever since. So we don't have the balanced research portfolio, at least in my view, that Bush so desperately wanted. And his argument against silos echoes today in a kind of hollow sense. Now, some policymakers in the administration have always argued, and argue today, that it would be good to keep having a multiplicity of mission-oriented agencies of government so that there's kind of a safety net provided for the support of basic research in case this one goes down, maybe that one's in favor, maybe the congressional relationships in this agency keep its budget up better than this one, and so forth. The idea that it's a venture capital portfolio, some losers, some winners, enough winners to make it pay off. That argument is probably a part of what lies beneath the other and much larger problem, namely research for military needs that was interfering with the adoption of Bush's report. And here there's a kind of unexpected piece of history. Bush had undertaken a very difficult fight with President Truman and the Joint Chiefs of Staff over various aspects of weapons policy, not just having to do with the arrangement of agencies, but other aspects of weapons policy. It came out in a way that left some decision-making that Bush ought to have had some responsibility for at OSRD. Instead, in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a position that didn't help Bush's wish for civilian control over military research. Naturally, the services disagreed. And when Congress actually passed legislation approving the National Science Foundation, as it already was being called, in 1947, Truman vetoed it, objecting to the delegation of appointment power to the private members that had been proposed by Bush. Well, that was bad enough and pretty hard for Bush to swallow, one imagines. But there was an unexpected flanking maneuver that was taking place at the same time, which was probably more damaging than Bush's difficulties with the Joint Chiefs and with President Truman. The Office of Naval Research had already undertaken a dramatic program of supporting basic research in universities. Not only was the funding generous, the red tape was minimal, and the agency was the agenda was remarkably broad. The agency was interested in all kinds of things. I was a graduate student at Harvard with Donald R. Griffin, and we were interested in vision and in sensory physiology and orientation, and Donald Griffin studied bat sonar and how bats navigate and how birds migrate and how they find their way home. Well, the Navy thought that was terrific stuff. And we had in the biological laboratory's parking lot two or three field vehicles. Well, these field vehicles were Navy trucks with Navy seals on them, painted battleship gray. And we would take them out spelunking and capturing bats and so forth. And it was quite wonderful that the Navy was really supporting that kind of research. Very far away from Bush's plan for a single agency that would manage various kinds of research. But we were sort of grateful for those trucks and thought that the tolerance of the Office of Naval Research was something worth applauding. So although Bush saw it as another case of fractionating research into a number of disconnected mission agencies and didn't propose or prescribe any kind of balance, Sid Galler, the ONR research director, who was a sort of a genius of a research manager, and his cohorts at ONR were clever, and gradually basic research objectives were being undertaken by the Department of Defense in a number of sectors. There was the Air Force Office of Scientific Research and this one over here, and of course the Department of the Atomic Energy Commission and the Department of Energy eventually began doing the same thing, though in the view of many contemporary scientists supported by the Department of Energy, not enough of it. Well, Bush's biographers have seen his failure, for the most part, as the result of political naivete of a sort and perhaps a certain sense that science policy ought to be the business of a group of experienced and qualified scientists rather than a matter of more general public or political interests. Well, instead, it turned out to be the business of politics and of bureaucrats who saw their own positions and on organizing science in terms of the welfare of their specific missions. If there's a single driver that brought the Bush plan down, in the view of many, it was a widely shared conviction that Bush was a brilliant conceptualizer, had wonderful visions, was devoted to a particular view of what science ought to be, but that he also represented a particular culture that took social responsibility and the principled conduct of human affairs to be core values, and that he knew he had the right idea and was prepared to insist on it and to defy opponents on the basis of their own rather more special concerns. In short, he was an elitist at a time when the kinds of convictions that he had and others like him had helped the Allies win a war, in part by using science well. But as the book Tuxedo Park, which incidentally is written by James Conant's granddaughter-in-law, suggests, some of the Bush and some of his post-war colleagues were members of what Nicholas Lehman was later to call the New England Episcopacy. In the political turmoil of converting a wartime government in peacetime, his views and perhaps his persona encountered a different kind of opposition than ones that the opposition that he had experienced in OSRD or in leading the wartime league of scientific experts that shared his views. Well, despite Bush's disappointment that several elements of his plan failed, the endless frontier did establish a really remarkable thing. It put U.S. research universities at the very heart of the nation's science effort, encouraging the growth of physical infrastructure and encouraging good ideas with generous project funding. As the National Institutes of Health rapidly expanded its grants for extramural research and developed a competitive peer review system that became a standard, the National Science Foundation finally achieved statutory life in 1950. It began a rather languid existence, but the Soviet orbiting of Sputnik in 1957 changed that dramatically, and that was followed then by a slow but steady growth. I might just make another point about the Sputnik anniversary, which we celebrated just now, and which was a terribly important event. Here's a country of people who had come through a war in the middle of a Cold War. All of a sudden, they've received promises from their government about science. They were going to contribute the Vanguard project to the forthcoming International Geophysical Year, and all of a sudden, what they regarded as a peasant nation had orbited something, the first thing ever to fly around the Earth, going meep, 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 meep. There was not only considerable panic, but there was a kind of political arousal that produced stunning results. NASA came into existence within a few months. The National Defense Education Act followed in the succeeding year. There was a science advisor to the president. Finally, James Killian came down from MIT to be science advisor. And so all of a sudden, the world had really changed in an important way. And the future of science funding in the government couldn't have had a better extra guarantee beyond the endless frontier. Well, I want to say that the 20 years from 1955 to 1975 were just very exciting times for the growth of science in American research universities. I was in one of them for all that time. The data tell the story. The construction and renewal of facilities, major research equipment blossomed, supported by NIH programs that were designed to repair the infrastructure. We got a new building for them. We got the last little trickle of money from the National Health Research Facilities Act for refinishing the basement. I remember that. I remember it was a long time ago, because when we had the site visit for that thing, we were getting in the new building, we were getting loud noises from the stadium down the way. Why were they excited? Well, it was a long time ago. Jim Plunkett was playing quarterback. I mean, you just get a sense that things were happening at an interesting point in time. Federally supported building activities proceeded, but tapered off around 68 and were nearly over by the late 70s. Program support continued to grow. However, there was a kind of slump in the mid to late 70s. But in 1972, my last year as chairman of the biology department, I think we had two dozen faculty members. Every one of them had a grant. Every one of our graduates, our PhD candidates, had either an NIH training grant, an NIH competitive fellowship, or an NSF competitive fellowship. We had to make people We had to beg people to be teaching assistants because they were so well supported. Some of you may remember those good days. So there was a partnership, and it looked very much like a terrific partnership. I would say that the faculty attitudes I encountered in the sciences during this period at Stanford and those I knew here at Cal were upbeat about what was going on. At Stanford and in some other places, I suspect, there was a feeling on the part of professors in the humanities and maybe the social sciences that the richness of scientific opportunity had caused the university to become a victim of asymmetric growth. Administrators contended that the gains for science funding allowed economic rebalancing from the general funds of the university, and that really all the boats were being lifted at once. I think that was partly true, but the argument somehow went a lot better with the biologists than it did with the professors of English and philosophy, and it was always something that we had to explain. Accompanying the concerns arising out of views about intra-institutional equity were other problems, especially affecting the sciences. Support had grown in a most welcome way, but accompanying that growth came certain requirements that drew strength from the fact that if people are supplying the funds, they get to make some of the rules. Perhaps the first to draw attention were rules regarding laboratory safety, animal care, human subjects, and the like. Process regulations that were largely understood to be legitimate because they were public health measures for the protection of experimenters and their subjects. But then later rules came along that gave the government a heavier role in establishing the ground rules of the partnership. New rules about cost sharing increased the university's share of the bill for research grants, mandated exclusions from the base used to determine indirect cost return, followed gradually, and downward pressure on the indirect cost rates came along. And the latter, I must say in full candor, was certainly helped a little, at least for a while, by Stanford's difficulties in the investigations by the Dingell Committee of indirect cost rates at Stanford, in which I was personally involved and eventually left the presidency. Later, by the way, there were findings favoring Stanford and its officers, but you know it was an effect and it was not good. Finally, public attention to a few instances of research misconduct in university laboratories led NIH and the Congress to take a special interest in the question whether science being supported by the public is being conducted in an ethically responsible way. NIH instituted a requirement that all of its trainees and all of its fellowship holders would have to take a course provided by the university in the ethical conduct of research. I taught in such a course for a dozen years, and I suspect I enjoyed it rather more than the students did, because you know there were some interesting subjects and you could create scenarios and kind of test them out on the students. But you know it is worth considering whether had part of the deal been at the beginning of the partnership that the universities would have to accept requirements in its own curriculum, there might have been some questions raised on the part of faculty members about whether that was really okay. One other aspect of this, of course, is the concern of the government with the ethical conduct of research. There were many prominent cases that appeared and disappeared without much notice, but some involved figures of such great prominence and congressional investigations that were such exercises in political theater that they really did achieve operatic length and attention. Perhaps the most public and unfair, in my view, was the assault on David Baltimore by the committee chaired, once again, by my friend John Dingell. After a long period of being left to twist in the wind, the Baltimore's collaborator was found innocent of research misconduct. So was Robert Gallo and a collaborator of his. After investigations by the Orwellian named Office of Research Integrity at NIH. Now that those findings are reviewed by an appellate board of lawyers at the Department of Health and Human Services, there is much more of a sense that there is rule of law at NIH as well as elsewhere. So let me return now quickly to the central theme of the Bush report and close with that. It placed very special emphasis on the basic sciences, and in supporting that evidence, it pointed out that publication and the free communication of research results were essential. Repeatedly, it pictures fundamental science as being done in the universities and in the endowed laboratories, and he characterizes industry and government laboratories as the sector that must take this basic knowledge and use it to create products and services for human use. The report is largely silent on patenting and on intellectual property issues. But in one passage, the report asserts that scientific advances will proceed more rapidly and diffusion of knowledge will proceed more rapidly with diffusion of knowledge than under a policy of continued restriction of knowledge now in our possession. These themes are appropriate jumping-off places for later consideration. The value of free discussion, a knowledge commons for science, will appear as we explore secrecy and the occasional contests it has with scientific work. As for the relationship between the universities as the source of basic research and the commercial sector as the domain of application, that relationship has been significantly reworked or even re-engineered as the result of a dramatic shift in the role government asserts with respect to intellectual property. It's changed both science and the universities, and that's the subject of next week's lecture on the Bayh-Dole amendments and their role in changing science in the university and creating a kind of penumbra of associated commercial exercises that has produced an interesting set of challenges, not only for faculty, but for university administrators and policymakers as well. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.